She looked up into his eyes, brown with just a hint of green, and gritted her teeth. It was going to be one of those nights. It had gone too far now for it not to be. But she might reduce the oncoming damage by playing her part.
"At what price, Lil?" Maddie asked.
Lily could almost see her now, smirking, her blonde hair tied up into the goth girl pigtails she'd favoured since she was about 9. Maddie had never met Greg. She'd disappeared 2 years before Lily first brought Greg home. And yet, even in the beginning, the good days, Lily had always known deep down what Maddie would have thought. Greg tugged harder now, pulling Lily's hair, hurting her scalp, and she opened her mouth, not knowing if she meant to say it or not. Even if Dorian couldn't eat solid food, she would need something. Maybe Lily could bring her some soup. Chicken broth, that should be safe enough. That was what invalids always ate in books. Lily should give Dorian some books, too, from her hidden stash, so that she wouldn't be bored.
"You do love me, don't you, Lil?"
"What if she can't read?"
"Lil, say you love me."
"No."
The word was out before she could pull it back, and Greg flung her across the living room into the teak cabinet that housed the screen. Lily's forehead hit first, splitting open and leaving a smear of blood on the dark wood. The cut didn't hurt so much, but then her midsection also ran into the corner of the cabinet, knocking the wind out of her. It felt like someone had kicked her intestines in. Lily opened her mouth but couldn't speak. Her breath was stuck somewhere in her throat, trying to get down into her lungs, allowing only a series of hoarse gasps. Blood trickled into her left eye, and when she looked up, she saw Greg approaching through a haze of scarlet. The rug was scattered with drops of blood.
"What did you say to me?"
Good question. Lily had put a lock on her throat a long time ago so that everything would need to pass through a filter before coming out. There was a very real lock there now, a physical one. She struggled to draw breath. But the other lock, the one that mattered, it had broken wide open. She wiped blood from her eye and braced herself as Greg bent down toward her. His face was red with anger, and the corners of his eyes had squeezed down into deep pockets. But the eyes themselves, they were empty.
"Want to apologize?"
Part of her did. If she apologized and did it well, he would fuck her and then leave her alone for the rest of the night. If she wasn't such a good actress, he might give her a few more sporting injuries and then fuck her anyway.
"Going to be a bad night."
He was about to hit her again. His fist hadn't even clenched, but over the past year, Lily had developed good radar for such things. She sensed the oncoming blow, perhaps even before the impulse had left Greg's own brain. She grabbed the leg of his grey suit pants with one bloody hand and pulled herself up into a crouch before he could jump backward. Her stomach was still hitching, but as she straightened and stood, everything relaxed inside her, and she drew a pure, clean breath of air that seemed to fill her up.
"You got blood on my suit."
Greg's tone was astonished, as though Lily had defied gravity.
"Now I'll have to change."
"How terrible for you."
He grabbed her by the hair and threw her out of the corner. Lily tripped over the coffee table, barking her shin, and landing in a pile of government flyers that flew everywhere, scattering across the living room floor. She tried to shove herself up, but Greg was behind her, pushing her back down as if she weighed nothing, pinning her against the coffee table. He pulled up her dress, and Lily fought harder, suddenly understanding what was going to happen next. She thought of the woman in the nursery, the bullet hole in her stomach. How brave she had been. She held the idea tightly as Greg ripped her panties off and shoved inside her. He'd planted his arm in the small of her back to keep her still. But Lily hitched involuntarily as she felt something tear deep inside her on the left side. A groan was climbing up the back of her throat, but she bit down on the skin of her hand. Greg would like it if she made a hurt sound. There was no logic to this. It was simply something she knew. Movement from over her shoulder caught her eye. She looked backward past Greg's arm pinning her neck and saw an upside-down Jonathan standing in the front hall behind her, frozen, his eyes wide. His car keys were still in his hand. Shame crashed down on Lily. She did her best to hide the bruises, knowing very well that she wasn't fooling anyone. Jonathan knew the score. He had taken her to the emergency room when Greg broke her arm. But this was much worse, and everything in Lily screamed that it had to be hidden. She couldn't watch it reflected in anyone's eyes but her own. Jonathan took a step forward, reaching beneath his jacket and pulling out his gun. Lily shook her head frantically. Jonathan could probably stop Greg, even without the gun. Greg was bigger, but Jonathan was combat-trained. But then what would happen? Greg would fire Jonathan without a thought, hire Lily a new bodyguard. Jonathan might even go to prison. And then what would happen to the woman in the nursery? Or to me? Jonathan took another silent step forward, raising the gun, his eyes fixed on Greg. Lily drew a hitching breath and gasped, "No!" This only served to egg Greg on. He began to thrust faster. But it had also stopped Jonathan. He paused, gun in hand, on the bottom step into the living room. Lily gave him a small smile through gritted teeth. A smile meant to tell him that she would get through it, that she was looking beyond the next few minutes. She rolled her eyes to the left toward the nursery. The Separatist. Jonathan hesitated for a long moment, eyes gleaming and hand clutching the banister. Then he tucked the gun back inside his jacket and disappeared into the shadows of the hallway as silently as he'd come. 2 hours later, Lily hobbled slowly toward the nursery. She'd meant to check on the woman much sooner, but in the end she broke down and took a hot bath. Even after an hour soaking in the tub, she could barely walk. She would have taken some aspirin and gone to bed, but she didn't like the idea of the injured woman sitting in the dark nursery alone. Lily didn't know whether Jonathan had gone to check on her. He appeared to have disappeared from the property again. Greg had gone to Washington for his crisis meeting at the Pentagon. Above the stone wall around the garden, Lily could still see the orange bloom of flames, the thick smoke that obscured the moon. They hadn't been able to get the fire under control yet, and Pryor was still burning. Had Dorian Rice built the bomb herself? Where had she learned that kind of thing, young as she was? The Blue Horizon recruited many veterans, both men and women, who had returned from the oil wars to find themselves unemployed. But Dorian looked too young to have done a single tour of duty. When Lily reached the nursery, she slid the dimmer switch on the wall panel up slowly, not wanting to scare the woman if she was asleep. But Dorian was awake, lying on the couch and staring at the ceiling, looking lucid for the first time. Lily set a bowl of broth and a glass of water on the table in front of her, and Dorian nodded thanks. She had sharp eyes. They tracked Lily's every movement and grimace as she limped across the room. "Looks like we've both been through it today," Dorian remarked. "Where are we?"
"My nursery."
Lily reached the loose tile, but now she faced a logistical problem. Squatting was simply not going to happen. Not tonight. She was reduced to pawing at the tile with her toes. After an interminable period, during which she could feel the young woman's eyes pinned to her back, she managed to work a toenail beneath the edge of the tile and flip it up and over. She bent one knee and stuck her other foot out, gracefully, like a ballet dancer, flipped two books out of the hole, and pushed them over to Dorian, who picked them up off the floor and flipped through them appreciatively.
"Where's a woman like you get real books?"
Lily bit her lip, not sure how much to tell. What if this woman were taken for interrogation? Dorian grinned, showing a missing incisor.
"You're already in plenty of trouble, honey."
There are a few other wives in the neighborhood who like to read. One of them has family in California with some kind of collection. They bring her books whenever they come to visit, and we pass them around.
Michelle could also procure pharmaceutical-grade painkillers for anyone who needed them.
Lily wished she had some now.
Does anyone know I'm here?
Jonathan does. He went to let some other people know.
I won't be here long, then.
You can stay as long as you like.
Dangerous for you. I bet security's all over this town.
Yes.
When they don't find me, they'll start searching houses.
Something new to worry about. But Dorian didn't look particularly worried, so Lily shrugged and tried to look nonchalant as she sat down carefully in her favorite armchair. She tightened up everything in preparation for the landing, gritting her teeth. But when her ass met the cushion, it still started all over again. She should have taken the aspirin.
Dorian yawned. I'm getting sleepy. If you decide to call security, do me a favor and shoot me in the head first.
I won't call anyone.
Good, because I'm not going back into custody.
Lily swallowed. She thought again of the blank door. That day in Manhattan, the group of uniformed men hustling the man in the suit inside. She had never found a single article or news report about what went on behind that door.
What's it like?
What?
Custody.
Oh, it's wonderful. They serve you steak and whiskey, and when you go to bed, there's a little mint waiting on your pillow.
I'm only curious.
Why do you care?
My sister.
But Lily found she couldn't finish that thought. Did she really want to know what had happened to Maddie behind that door?
Nobody talks about it.
Dorian shrugged.
It's bad. For women, especially.
Women have a bad time everywhere.
Oh, get off it, rich lady. Sure, you walked in here limping and shuffling, but we've all done that walk. You should be thankful he was the only one.
Lily swallowed again. The throb between her legs, the raw, rubbed skin, suddenly felt much worse.
I need to sleep. You can go.
I'll stay until you're asleep.
There's no need for that.
Lily leaned back in the armchair, crossing her arms.
Fine. Christ.
Dorian closed her eyes.
Wake me up if he comes.
Who?
Lily almost asked, then answered herself. No names. She lit the small scented candle that sat on the table beside the armchair, then whispered to the house to turn off the overhead light. Shadows flickered on the walls, highlighting Lily as a matronly figure, an old woman in her rocking chair.
We've all done that walk.
She watched Dorian fall asleep. Her mind kept on trying to turn to Greg to go over the evening, but Lily wouldn't allow it. She would think about these things tomorrow, in the light of day, but not now. But the images, the sensations kept on coming until she thought she might bolt from the chair and scream.
What would Maddie do?
But that was easy.
Maddie wouldn't have shied away from remembering. Maddie would have gone all the way through it.
Maddie had always been tough,
and Lily, who had been delighted at the idea of a younger sister, quickly became disenchanted when she realized that Maddie was never going to want to play any of the same games as herself. No dress-up, no beauty parlor, no cooking in the fake kitchen that sat in the corner of the living room. Maddie liked baseball, insisted on wearing pants. By the time she was 12, she was the best pitcher in the neighborhood, so good that the neighborhood boys not only allowed her to play in their impromptu baseball league, but always picked her first. But being a tomboy was only part of it. Maddie was much smaller than Lily, tiny and pixie-like, but she had no tolerance for bullshit. She was unable to keep silent, even when silence would save her trouble or pain. Their elementary school had had two bullies, and by the time Maddie started sixth grade, she had dealt with both of them. In eighth grade, she took several suspensions for arguing with the canned government information being peddled by her history teacher. Maddie was born to be a defender of the weak, of the helpless. Maddie was the first to tell Lily that millions of people were living outside the fences that surrounded media. People who didn't have enough food. People who owed so much money that they would never be free of their debts. Until then, Lily had had no idea that not everyone lived the way their family did. Dad told her the truth as well, but many years later, when Lily was 15. Even though Maddie was the youngest, Dad had clearly told her the truth of things long before. The woman, Dorian, moaned in her sleep, jerking Lily back to the present. Drops of sweat gleamed on Dorian's forehead in the candlelight. Lily cast around and found the bowl of melted ice she had brought up earlier. She hauled herself from the chair, wincing, dipped her towel in the cold water, and wrung it out, and then placed it gently on Dorian's forehead. The towel turned warm almost immediately, and Lily dipped it again, replaced it. She should get Dorian some aspirin. But no, the doctor had left some pills for fever. Lily seemed unable to feel sure of anything. She had been at her father's sickbed, but she didn't know how to take care of sick people. The nurses and machines had done all of the work. Toward the end, when Dad was pumped full of drugs, he had asked for Maddie, and Lily couldn't bring herself to explain where Maddie was, to make him go through it again. She had told him that Maddie was down the hall talking to the doctor, but Dad kept on asking, right until the end. They had a special bond, Dad and Maddie, and because that bond seemed to have always been there, Lily had no time to develop resentment. Dad took Maddie to Phillies games in the summer, and he would sit with her in his study at night, the two of them reading endless books together. Even though Maddie was 2 years younger than Lily, she was the first to learn to read on her own. This was the crucial difference between the two of them, and the crucial similarity between Maddie and Dad. Maddie cared deeply about things. "If we could be better people," she would say, "if we could care about each other as much as we do about ourselves, think about it, Lily. Think what the world would be." Lily would not, for this sounded good in theory. But Lily had no such deep drives. Anything she cared about was discarded as uninteresting 2 months later. Maddie's passions were exhausting. They demanded not only interest, but commitment and effort. Sometimes Lily had wished that Maddie would just think about boys and clothes and music, as all of Lily's friends did, as Lily did herself. The candle flame flickered sharply, and Lily looked up at the walls where the shadows of her familiar nursery furniture had turned grotesque in the thin candlelight. The house was supposed to be airtight to protect against a chemical attack, but she felt a draught from somewhere, chilling her toes. The cold had not woken Dorian, though. She slept on peacefully, her head lolling sideways on the pillow. For a moment, she looked so much like Maddie that Lily could almost believe this woman was her sister. But then the shadows shifted again, and the illusion was broken. That Maddie would be politically active was almost a foregone conclusion. Their childhood was not a good time for anyone to be political. But Lily had only realized this years later when she learned about the Frewell administration. One of Lily's English teachers, Mr. Hawthorne, had disappeared when she was halfway through eighth grade, and Lily had not questioned the school's announcement that Mr. Hawthorne had moved to California. Only in college did she remember that Mr. Hawthorne had been prone to sweeping pronouncements about the impact of religion on society, that he often assigned books with this theme. Back then, federal editing of individual works of literature was still new, and Mr. Hawthorne had always managed to secure the original versions for their readers. But one day, he was simply gone, replaced with a substitute who used the approved editions. Mr. Hawthorne vanished perhaps 2 months before Maddie did, and Lily, who had barely cared at the time, often wondered now, again, in those moments before sleep, when everything took on an exaggerated importance, and even fever dreams seemed reasonable, how he had gotten caught. A student, probably. A student, as thoughtless as Lily, talking because she loved to talk, meaning no harm. She was being watched. Lily knew it suddenly, in every nerve ending. Someone was standing just inside the door to the patio, looking down at her. Greg, back from Washington early, here to check on her, to see what his doll was up to. Greg didn't come into the nursery, but that wouldn't be the only line crossed tonight, would it? Lily would look up and see his grinning face, his bully's cheerfulness, and she would have nothing left. She made herself look up, and relief nearly choked her. It wasn't Greg. The man had entered the room without making a sound, and now he leaned against the closed door, watching her. He was perhaps 40, a tall man with a military bearing that showed clearly despite his relaxed posture. He wore all black. His blonde hair was cropped almost brutally short, but it suited the face beneath, a severe, clean-shaven face, all angles and hard curves.
"How is she?"
Lily blinked at his accent, which wasn't American. "She's fine. She's got a fever, but the doctor said that might happen. I'll stay with her until it breaks." The man inspected her closely, studying her face.
"You're Mrs. Mayhew."
Lily nodded slowly, identifying the accent. English. She hadn't heard an English voice in a long time. It had been more than 10 years since security had closed the border to the UK and expelled all of the Brits. What was he still doing here?
"Have you ever seen me before?"
he asked. "No."
"You sure?"
"Yes."
She was sure. She would have remembered this man. He exerted pull, a magnetism that Lily could feel all the way across the room.
He lifted a black canvas bag, smaller than the doctor's, but still clearly medical. Lily heard the light ring of metal instruments inside when he set it on the table.
"I don't know why you helped her, but thank you. Unexpected help is the best kind."
"Why is it unexpected? Because I'm rich."
"That, and your husband."
For a moment, Lily could only think of the scene in the living room. Then she realized that he must be talking about Greg's job. Greg didn't work for the government, not exactly, but by now security practically was the government. In the eyes of the Blue Horizon, Greg was just as bad as any politician. The man's eyes were beginning to hypnotize her. With an effort, Lily turned back to Dorian. Why did she blow up the naval base? It seemed so pointless.
"Nothing we do is pointless. You only judge because you can't see the whole picture."
"I don't judge."
"Of course you do. Why wouldn't you? This is a lofty perch you sit on."
Lily flushed, and she suddenly found herself wanting to contradict him, to explain about Greg, to tell this man how the perch wasn't so lofty at all. But she couldn't say any of that to a stranger. She couldn't even say it to her friends.
"Boss?"
Dorian asked from the couch.
"There you are, love."
Dorian smiled, a sleepy smile that turned her face into that of a child.
"Knew you'd come.
Did it work?"
"Beautifully. Months before they can fly again. You did a good job."
Dorian's eyes brightened.
"Sleep, Dory. Heal up."
Dorian closed her eyes. Lily didn't know what to make of this exchange. Clear affection between the two of them, yes. But what man sent the woman he loved to plant explosives, to be shot?
"I have to get her out of here,"
the man murmured, his eyes troubled. "She can stay as long as she needs to."
"Until you tire of the novelty and turn her in."
"I won't," Lily snapped back, stung. "I would never do that."
"Forgive me my skepticism."
"The doctor said she shouldn't be moved," Lily insisted, alarmed, for the man had risen from his armchair
and she saw that he meant to pick Dorian up and carry her out. Lily sprang from her own armchair, then hissed in pain as all of her separate wounds woke up at once.
"Seen some rough handling, haven't we, Mrs. Mayhew? Who's done that to your face?"
"None of your business." He nodded, his eyes bright, and Lily saw that he already knew. Maybe not everything, but more than she wanted him to. "Don't take her away, please."
"Why not?"
Lily cast around for more of the doctor's words. "There might be roadblocks."
"There are 3 roadblocks around New Canaan, Mrs. Mayhew. They're no impediment to me."
"Please." Lily was appalled to find herself near tears. The entire day seemed to have crashed down on her all at once. The horrible surgery, Greg, Maddie. And now this man who wanted to take Dorian away before Lily could atone for anything. "Please let her stay."
"What's your interest here, Mrs. Mayhew? Might as well tell me. I'll know if you're lying. Are you looking to collect a reward?"
"No." He bent toward Dorian again. Lily fumbled for words, for any excuse, but she came up with nothing. Only the truth. "I turned my sister in." He looked up sharply.
"What?"
Lily tried to stop, but the words came tumbling out. "My sister. I turned her into security 8 years ago. I didn't mean to, but I did. Dorian looks just like her." He studied her closely for a moment, his eyes narrowed.
"What's your maiden name, Mrs. Mayhew?"
"Freeman."
"Good name for a separatist. What did your sister do?"
"Nothing." Lily closed her eyes, feeling tears threatening to swamp her again. "She had a pamphlet in her room. I didn't know what it was at the time."
"You showed it to someone."
Lily nodded, and the tears began to slide down her cheeks. "My friends. One of them had a father who worked for security, but I never thought about that. I just wanted to know what Maddie was doing."
"How old were you?"
17. Maddie was 15.
"Did they come for her?"
Lily nodded again, unable to speak. She had no way to explain that morning. The way it never changed in her memory, no matter how badly she wished it to. Lily, standing by her locker, surrounded by her own friends, all of them glued to their phones. Maddie, coming out of a classroom 30 feet away. And just around the corner, not yet seen, the 4 security officers closing in. Sometimes Lily had dreams, hopeless nightmares in which she reached for Maddie, grabbed her arm at the last minute and helped her duck into a classroom, behind a door, out the window. But even her dreaming self knew it was futile, that any moment the 4 men in black uniforms would come around the corner, that 2 of them would grab each of Maddie's arms and escort her down the hallway, that Lily's last glimpse of her sister would be a flash of blonde pigtails before the doors closed. At dinner, the 3 of them, Mum and Dad and Lily, had waited for Maddie to turn up. They had waited through the night as well, and into the next morning. Dad had got on the phone with every important person he knew, and Mum cried almost non-stop. But Lily was silent, some deep and awful part of her already beginning to put 2 and 2 together, to understand what she had done. Dad was only an engineer. His clout was nowhere near strong enough to get a prisoner released, especially not one with suspected separatist ties. They had waited for days and then weeks, but Maddie had never come home. She had vanished into the vast dark mechanism of security. The doctors said that Dad had died of cancer, but Lily knew the truth. Dad had been dying for a long time. Dying slowly and horribly of Maddie's disappearance years before. Mom didn't want to talk about it, didn't even want to think about it. She told friends that Maddie had run away, and when Lily tried to talk about it, Mom would simply ignore her, turning the conversation into a different path. Mom's attitude was maddening. But Dad's grief had been terminal. I killed him too, Lily often thought to herself in those defenseless moments right before sleep. I didn't mean to, but I killed my father. She looked up at the man in front of her, expecting judgment, but his face was neutral.
It's been eating you up, I see.
Lily nodded.
And you're using Dorian as what? Self-punishment?
Fuck you, Lily hissed. I'm not the one who sent her to blow up a jet field.
She volunteered.
He replied mildly. Please. Your group recruits people with nowhere else to go.
True. Most of them have nowhere else. But that's not why they volunteer.
Then why? He leaned forward, his remarkably light eyes gleaming in the candlelight. He steepled his hands, and Lily saw that his fingers were scarred and burned in several places. Whatever she had imagined when she thought of the blue horizon, it wasn't this man.
Tell me, Mrs. Mayhew, have you ever dreamed of a better world?
Who hasn't?
Anyone who profits by keeping the world as it is. You and your husband, for instance.
I don't profit by it, Lily muttered, wiping the tears from her cheeks.
Maybe not, he replied, his eyes going to the cut on her forehead. Profit is a relative thing. But regardless, there's a better world out there. I see it all
The Englishman broke off abruptly, tilting his head to one side. A moment later, Lily heard it as well, a siren, no more than a couple of streets away.
Time for me to be going.
He began digging in the medical bag on the table.
I thought I'd need this, but the doctor seems to have done well. Did he leave antibiotics?
Lily nodded. I'm supposed to give her one shot per day.
Good. Don't go shopping and forget.
Lily's cheeks coloured, but she didn't take the bait. She can stay?
Until I find a safe way to get her out. A few days at most.
He pulled a small white packet from the bag and held it out to Lily.
Take this. Pour a bit in the bath for a few days.
Take it for what? He stared down at her, his face unreadable.
You put on a good show, Mrs. Mayhew, but men like your husband rarely limit the damage to the outside.
Lily took the packet, trying not to touch his fingers. I suppose you think I have options.
Oh, I know you don't.
He closed the flap of his medical bag.
But don't lose all hope of the better world. It's out there, so close we can almost touch it.
What better world? The Englishman paused, deliberating. Lily had thought that his eyes were grey, but now she saw that they were actually bright silver, the colour of moonlight on water.
Picture a world where there are no rich and poor, no luxury, but everyone is fed and clothed and educated and cared for. God controls nothing. Books aren't forbidden. Women aren't the lower class. The colour of your skin, the circumstances of your birth, these things don't matter. Kindness and humanity are everything. There are no guns, no surveillance, no drugs, no debt, and greed holds no sway at all.
Lily fought against his voice, but not hard enough, for she glimpsed his better world for a moment, clear and limned in shades of blue and green. A village of small wooden houses, of pure kindness, beside a river surrounded by trees.
Wake up, Lily.
She dug her fingernails into her palms. I'm told that pipe dreams go better with lubricant. His shoulders shook with silent amusement.
That's late night, Mrs. Mayhew, but you did ask the question.
He opened the patio door and stood framed for a moment in the doorway, listening to the night. He was taller than Greg, Lily saw now, but whereas Greg was still bulky from his football years, this man was agile, with the lithe muscles of a runner or a swimmer. When he turned back to her,
she noticed a long, jagged scar running down the side of his neck.
"Do you want to help us further?"
"Help you how?"
"We can always use information. Anything you can pass along via Jonathan would be helpful."
"How did Jonathan join up with you?"
"That's his story to tell."
"How did you get over the New Canaan Wall?"
"There are ways through every barrier, Mrs. Mayhew."
Lily blinked, stunned by the calm assurance of this statement. "Who are you?"
She knew what she would get. No names.
The Englishman stepped through the door, and Lily ignored him, staring resolutely at the sleeping woman on the sofa. He had allowed Dorian to stay, but Lily felt as though she had already lost something. Soon they would both be gone, Dorian and this man. And what would Lily have then? A lifetime with Greg? An eternity of nights like tonight? This brief glimpse of another life would make that future 1,000 times worse. When the man spoke, his reply was so unexpected that Lily froze in her chair, and by the time she looked up, he had already vanished into the night.
"My name is William Tyr."
Book 2 Chapter 6 Ewan. Even small gestures of kindness have the potential to reap enormous rewards. Only the short-sighted man believes otherwise. The Glynn Queen's words, as compiled by Father Tyler. The Cadaris ambassador, Ajmal Khatan, was a charmer, tall, sharp-witted and handsome, with almond-coloured skin and a blinding white smile. Kelsey liked him immediately, despite Mace's warning that this was exactly the sort of ambassador the King of Kadair always sent to women, smooth and plausible and seductive. Catan's tear was imperfect, but even his accent was engaging, riddled with pauses before long words and a sharp drop on the penultimate vowel. He had brought Kelsey a beautiful chess set carved from marble, kings and rooks and bishops with intricately detailed faces, and she accepted the gift happily. After their return from the Argive, she had sent several keep servants to clean out Carlin and Barty's cottage, and among assorted other things they had brought back Carlin's old chess set. Both Arliss and Mace were good players. Arliss could beat Kelsey 2 times of 3, but Carlin's set was old, whittled by Barty, no doubt, of plain wood, and beginning to show its wear. It had great sentimental value to Kelsey, but the new set would be more durable for play. Mace had warned Kelsey that the Cadaris placed great value on appearances, and as such she had not wanted to conduct this meeting in the large central room of the Queen's Wing that usually served for such functions. At her urging, Mace had finally relented and moved the throne back down to the massive audience chamber several floors below. When not filled with people, the chamber felt ridiculously cavernous, so they had also thrown this audience open to the public. Tyr nobles had more or less stopped attending Kelsey's audiences once they realized that no gifts would be dispensed from the throne, and Mace and Kelsey had decided on a simple, fair system. The first 500 people who came to the keep gate could attend the audience, so long as they submitted to a search for weapons. Kelsey had found that clothing was a fairly reliable index of wealth. Some of the people who stood in front of her were clearly of the entrepreneurial class, probably dealing in lumber, if not something less legal. But the majority of the audience was poor, and Kelsey had the regrettable thought that most of them had come here for entertainment. Her first few public audiences had featured quite a bit of talk, and some occasional catcalling from the crowd, but Mace had taken care of that, announcing that anyone who captured his attention could look forward to a private conference. Now, Kelsey barely heard a peep. "My master begs that you will honour him with a visit," the ambassador said. "Perhaps one day," Kelsey replied, seeing Mace frown. "At the moment, I have too much to do."
"Indeed, you have the full plate. You have provoked the ageless queen. My master admires your bravery.
Has your master never provoked her?
No. His father did, and received a painful reminder. Now we pay twice as much in glass and horses.
Perhaps that's the difference. We were paying in humans. A moment later, Kelsey remembered that the Cadarees also sent slaves to Mortmain, but the ambassador did not seem to take offense.
Yes, we've heard this as well. You forbid human traffic within your borders. My master is greatly entertained.
There was an insult wrapped in the last statement, but Kelsey made no attempt to unpack it. She needed help from the Cadarese king, and she could not offend the ambassador by questioning him in front of his aides. But neither did she have time to engage in the lengthy and circuitous prelude to serious discussion that was fashionable in Cadair. This morning a message had arrived from Hall with bad news. General Ducat had taken command of the Mort army. Everyone in the Queen's wing seemed to know a horror story about Ducat, and although the border villages had already been evacuated and Bermond was now beginning to clear out the eastern Almont, even a successful evacuation would accomplish nothing if Ducat got to New London. The city's defences were weak. The eastern side had a high wall, but that wall was too close to the Cadell River, built on watery ground. The western side of the city had nothing. Her mother had trusted the natural defence of the Clayton Mountains to protect the west against a prolonged siege. But Kelsey was not so sanguine. She wanted a western wall around the city, but Mace estimated that they had less than 2 months until the Mort reached the city. Even if she conscripted every stonemason in New London, they would never build it in time. But Cadair had many masons, the best stoneworkers in the New World. Even if the king was unwilling to supplement the Tyr army with his own forces, perhaps Kelsey could get him to lend her some of his craftsmen. At the very least, she needed him to stop sending horses to Mortmain. There was a saying, only lightly exaggerated, that a sick Cadarese mare could outrun a healthy Tyr yearling. Better horses weren't much use to the Mort up in the border hills. But once they got down into the Almont, superior cavalry would be a crushing advantage. She needed these negotiations to bear fruit.
"Shall we get down to business, Ambassador?"
Catan's eyebrows rose.
"You move quickly, Majesty."
"I'm a busy woman." Catan settled in his chair, looking a bit disgruntled.
"My master wishes to discuss an alliance."
Kelsey's heart leapt. A murmur ran through the audience chamber, but Mace didn't react. He was too busy staring at the ambassador with narrowed, suspicious eyes.
"My master, likewise, wishes to reduce his tribute to the Mort," Catan continued, "but neither Cadair nor the Tierling is strong enough to do so alone."
"I agree. What would the terms of this alliance be?"
"Slowly, slowly, Majesty," Catan insisted, waving his hands.
And that was Kelsey's real clue that she would not like what was coming. The ambassador felt the need to wend his way into it.
"My master recognizes your bravery in defying the Mort, and would reward you accordingly."
"Reward me how?"
"By making you first among his wives."
Kelsey froze, dumbfounded, hearing several of her guards mutter around her. She swallowed hard and managed to reply, though it felt as though her throat were full of moths.
"How many wives does your king have?"
23, Majesty."
"Are they all Cadarese?"
"All but two, Majesty. Those two are Mort, gifts from the ageless queen."
"What are the ages of these wives?" The ambassador looked away and cleared his throat.
"I am not sure, Majesty."
"I see." Kelsey wanted to kick herself. She should have seen it coming. Mace had told her that the Cadarese were isolationists, that their assistance would come with heavy strings. but she didn't think that even Mace had foreseen such an offer. She scrambled to think of a counter-proposal. What is the value of being the first wife?
You sit immediately beside the master at table. You have first pick of all gifts delivered to the palace. Once you have produced a healthy son, you have the right to refuse the master's attentions, if you wish.
Corin had begun tapping his fingers on his sword. Elston appeared to be thinking of creative ways to disembowel the ambassador, and Kib placed a warning hand on his shoulder. But Mace... Kelsey was glad that Catan could not see Mace's expression, for there was murder there. What of an alliance without marriage?
My master is not interested in such an alliance.
Why not?
The King of Kadair cannot have an alliance on an equal footing with a woman. Marriage ensures that your majesty is seen to submit her will to my master in all things.
Mace moved in sharply, blocking off Kelsey's right side. She blinked in surprise, for she had sensed no threat from the ambassador or his guards. It took a few moments for her to see it. Mace had actually moved to protect the ambassador. Some of Kelsey's anger ebbed away then. She smiled at Mace and felt a rush of affection when he smiled back. Turning back to Catan, she asked, "Would your master expect to share my throne?"
"It is difficult for one man to govern two kingdoms, Majesty. Rather, my master would appoint a..."
Catan paused for a moment, searching for language. "Castellan, yes? A castellan, to oversee your throne on his behalf." "And I would live in Kadair?"
"Yes, Majesty, with my master's other wives."
Elston had begun to crack his knuckles now, slowly and obtrusively, one at a time. Catan, clearly sensing the thin ice between him, did not elaborate on the further joys of living in the king's harem, but merely waited silently for Kelsey's response. "This is the only offer you bring?"
"My master has not empowered me to make any other offer, Majesty."
Kelsey smiled gently. If she were the ruler Carlin had been trying to train, she might have taken Catan's deal, distasteful as it was. But she could not. An entire life seemed to flash before her eyes. The life of a Kadarese concubine outlined clearly before she pushed the thought out of her head. If it would save the Tierling, she would gladly give up her own life, stick a knife in her heart tomorrow. But this, she could not.
"I refuse."
"Yes, Majesty."
Catan looked up, his black eyes twinkling with sudden amusement.
"I cannot say that I am surprised."
"Why not?"
"We have heard all about your Majesty, even in Kadair. You have a will."
"Then why offer?"
"It is my job, Majesty, to carry the master's wishes and offers. Incidentally, this offer will remain open until my master withdraws it."
The ambassador leaned a few inches closer, lowering his voice.
"But for your sake, I am glad that you do not accept. You are not such a woman to be content in my master's harem."
Kelsey met his smiling eyes and felt her mouth twitch back. She found him attractive, she realized. Attractive in a way that only the fetch had been before. It was a wonderful feeling, almost like freedom. "Will you be staying with us long, Lord Ambassador?"
"Sadly, Majesty. I am to report back to my master as soon as negotiations are concluded. We will beg your hospitality for one night only."
"A pity."
But Kelsey knew it was probably for the best. She already spent far too much time thinking about the fetch, and another handsome man would only be a further distraction. Deep in her mind, a small voice rose in protest. Would she never deserve any pleasure for herself? But Kelsey smothered it easily. Whenever she needed a cautionary tale, her mother was always there, waiting in the back of her mind.
Mace cleared his throat, reminding Kelsey of her duties as a hostess. Cadere's hospitality had well-defined rules, and they would expect to share at least one meal with her before they left.
"Well, gentlemen, we have..."
Kelsey began. But she got no further, for the doors at the other end of the throne room suddenly exploded in commotion. Kelsey's guards drew in tight. Her memory doubled back to that terrible day of her crowning, and the muscles of her shoulder tensed automatically, bunching up beneath her scar. Something was happening at the doors. A group of Queen's guards and Tyr army had coalesced into a huddle. Several men shouted to be heard.
"What is it?"
Mace called across the room. No one answered him. An argument was clearly going on, army men bickering with the guard. But finally, a group won through, two men hauling a third between them. They approached the throne slowly, haltingly, followed closely by soldiers and guards.
"Good Christ,"
Mace muttered. Kelsey, whose eyesight was not good, had to wait a few moments. But as the three men came closer, her mouth dropped open. On the left was her jailer, Ewan, his open, friendly face now scuffed with bruises, one eye swollen shut. On the right was Javel, the prisoner from the Argive. His wrists were manacled, but he appeared to be unharmed. Between them, nearly unconscious, bound with thick rope and bleeding from multiple wounds, was Arlan Thorne. Ewan recognized the man the moment he saw him. He didn't need the silence at the top of the dungeon stairs, where two soldiers were supposed to be on duty at all times. He didn't need the swift intake of breath by the woman in cell 2, or the way her eyes blazed as she stared up through the bars. He didn't even need the glimpse of the knife tucked behind the man's back. A tall, starving, thin man with bright blue eyes, the Queen had said. And when Ewan looked up and saw the scarecrow, he simply knew. Still, he was determined to handle things the right way. The scarecrow had a knife, and Ewan had three prisoners to think about. He was big enough to knock the scarecrow flying, and it was good to know that he would need no weapons to do so. But he also knew that he was big enough to accidentally kill the scarecrow with such a blow. Dad always warned Ewan to remember his own size. And the Queen, Ewan reminded himself, wanted this man alive. "Good afternoon," the scarecrow greeted Ewan, leaning over the desk. Javel, the prisoner in cell 3, sat bolt upright from his cot.
"How can I help you, sir?"
Ewan asked. From the corner of his eye, he saw that his other two prisoners, Brenner and Banneker, had moved up to stand at the bars. The torchlight played cruelly over the now-healing welts that covered Banneker's body, but his face was sly and expectant.
"The Queen has ordered me to transfer all three of your prisoners to the central New London jail," the scarecrow told Ewan.
He had a low, somehow unpleasant voice, and Ewan didn't even question how this man had gotten past the soldiers at the top of the stairs. He guessed they were already dead.
"I'm to escort them myself." "This is the first time I've heard about a transfer,"
Ewan replied.
"Give me a moment to note it in the book."
He pulled out the logbook and began to ink up his pen, trying to think. Dar had always told Ewan that he had the ability to be clever. It would just take some time and work. After Ewan finished with the book, the scarecrow would expect him to get up and walk over to the cells with his keys.
If Ewan could only get the scarecrow to walk in front, it would be easy to disarm him. But something told Ewan not to be too sure even of that. The scarecrow was skinny, yes, but he looked quick. He wore the black uniform of the Tyr army. If he was a soldier, he might have another knife hidden somewhere. "Your name, sir?"
Ewan asked.
"Captain Frost."
Ewan wrote as slowly as possible, his face screwed up as though in concentration. He couldn't simply launch himself at the scarecrow while seated at the table.
The table itself would flip over and act as a shield if it didn't kill the man outright. Ewan also had to make sure the man's knife didn't get into any of the cells. Dar had told Ewan that prisoners could use any sharp object to pick a lock.
Javel had moved up to stand at the bars of cell 3, and Ewan, who had grown accustomed to the man's dull, expressionless face, was shocked at what he saw there now.
Javel's expression was that of a hungry dog. His eyes, deep and dark, were glued to the scarecrow's back. There could be no more delays. Ewan pushed back his chair and got up, pulling the ring of keys from his belt.
He came around the right edge of the table, where it would be only natural for the scarecrow to move out of his way, to go in front of him.
But the scarecrow merely backed away a single step and pressed up against the wall, sweeping a hand toward the cell block.
"After you, Master Jailer."
Ewan nodded and moved forward, his heart thumping in his chest. He warned himself to be on guard, but even so he was taken by surprise, had only the barest fraction of a second to sense the hand around his neck, the knife coming for his throat. He reached up and batted the knife away, heard it clatter to the ground in the far corner behind him. The scarecrow jumped on Ewan's back, wrapped his arms around Ewan's throat and squeezed. Ewan bent double, trying to throw the scarecrow over his shoulders, but the man clung to him like a snake, his arms pressing tighter and tighter around Ewan's neck until the cells in front of Ewan were covered with black spots that bloomed wide when he tried to focus. He sought for air, but there was none. Blood was roaring in his ears, but he could still hear the woman, Brenna, hissing encouragement. Banneker, too, was holding the bars of his cell, hopping up and down in his excitement. And then there was Javel, silent, his eyes wide and unhappy, his hands outstretched as though to ward something off. The agony in Ewan's chest had become a fire that burned everything now, his arms and legs and head, and he didn't have the strength to pry the man loose. Stinging pain arrowed up from Ewan's palm. He thought for a moment, and then realized that he was still clutching his ring of keys, gripping them hard enough to draw blood. The world had turned to a dark, bruised purple, and Ewan suddenly realized that without air to breathe, he was going to die, that the scarecrow would kill him. Dar was dying, Ewan knew, but Dar was dying of old age, of sickness.
This wasn't the same.
Javel's unhappy face swam before him, and without warning, Ewan's mind made one of its odd connections. Javel didn't want this to happen. Javel was a prisoner, yes, a traitor. But somehow, he was not the Scarecrow's friend. All of Dar's old lectures about jailbreak echoed through Ewan's head. But before he could think about them, he had already flung the keys towards cell 3. He watched them clang off the bars and land just between them, saw a dirty hand scrabbling for them on the ground. Then the purple world darkened to black. When Ewan woke up, his head and chest were aching. His neck stung as though it had been scraped with a brick. He opened his eyes and saw the dungeon's familiar ceiling above him, grey stones caked with mould.
Dar always said that whoever had built the keep had done a good job, but it had become harder and harder over the years to prevent seepage from the moat. What had woken him up? The noise, of course. The noise to his right. Snarling sounds like a dog would make. A thick thud like a baker's fist sinking into dough. They had lived right next to a bakery when Ewan was growing up, and he loved to stand on his toes and watch the bakers through the windows. He wanted to close his eyes and go back to sleep, just as he would have on a Sunday morning long years ago, before he began to apprentice with Dar in the dungeon. The dungeon? Ewan's eyes snapped open. Again he saw the familiar pattern of mould on the ceiling. Stop! A woman shrieked, her voice echoing around the stone walls. It hurt Ewan's ears. He looked to his right and saw the ghost woman clutching the bars, screaming. On the floor beneath her, Javel was crouched over the scarecrow, pinning him down. Javel was laughing,
dark laughter that made Ewan's arms prickle. As he watched, Javel reared back and hit the other man squarely in the face.
"I have only one question for you, Arlen."
Javel's high cackle drowned out the woman's scream.